My name is Julia, and I am excited to welcome Steph and David, who are here from the Cascades Wolverine Project, and they are going to be talking all about the elusive wolverine, their habitat, and some of the project that they've been working on right in this valley. So thank you all for being here.
Thank you. Whoa, that scared me. Hope you're awake now. Thanks so much, Holden Village. Mark and Nancy have been really fundamental in giving us a really beautiful base camp here at the village. This is our third season here, and we thought we would be camping, but kind of moved up in the world, and we're eating great food and sleeping in warm beds, and it's a real pleasure. But not only that, Holden Village now has a monitoring station for wolverine that's going year-round. We just set up stations for the winter, so the village is a real steward for wolverines, which is very inspiring. So thank you to everyone here on staff who has supported us. So my name is Steph Williams, and I live in Twisp, Washington, which is from Chelan, about an hour drive to the north. And it was that valley, the Methow Valley where Twisp is where Washington had a 10-year wolverine live trapping study, which ended about 5 years ago. And on the tail end of that, there's been an effort from about 15 or 20 people in the state to continue working on wolverine research. And we are a small part of that, and so we do the North Cascades. But we also do some other things that are important, not just to the research. This is Stella, by the way. I'll get into this, but I just thought I'd introduce you to a wolverine that we got on camera last winter. But we also, in addition to monitoring wolverines here and in the outside of the Methow Valley, we're also initiating backcountry community science. And so this is really something that just our project does, and we're very proud of it. So we really tap into people who travel in the backcountry during winter, especially skiers. Because backcountry skiers get deep, high, far. They're in wolverine habitat. So getting this community, which is my community, I'm also a mountain guide, a ski guide, to be involved in wolverine research and conservation is really something that's also fundamental to our project. And David's going to be talking a lot about the visual storytelling, and that is essential for conservation, you know, really at all times, but especially now, because you can do a bunch of research on a threatened species, but if there's not a story connected to that animal, then people just won't care, right? Unless you're a geek, you know, like me, you just love the animal for the animal's sake. So we're going to talk about all of these things tonight. So the first question is, you know, will the real wolverine please stand up? I think that's a tribute to Eminem. I forgot where I got that. It came out of my brain somewhere. So there are some misperceptions about who this animal is. And actually, just to get a little hands-on, this is not a wolverine from the Cascades, but this is a wolverine from the western edge of the Bering Sea. And you can just pass this around. This is a part of a wolverine. The main energetic part is not there any longer, but at least you can, this might be the closest that you'll ever get to petting a wolverine. So some people feel most connected to wolverine through the Marvel Comics hero, Wolverine. I don't think that resembles this animal that much, but you know, he only has three claws, for example. So a wolverine has five claws. Some people associate the wolverine with Hugh Jackman. He also doesn't really look a whole lot. Again, it's the three claws thing. If you just had two more claws, maybe it'd be closer resemblance. Here's a wolverine that we've been encountering for the last couple of years. And so this is an animal that lives here in the mountains, very close to Holden Village, definitely up in the North Cascades, and actually all the way down now near Mount Rainier, and they're just expanding the range in recent times. So why does it matter? Okay, other than just the fact that the animal is really cool, and we'll talk more about that. But it matters in the big picture, so we're just going to zoom out for a moment. And it makes me a little, you know, hesitant to be the bearer of bad news, but I assume most people know that we're going through a biodiversity crisis worldwide. So more species are lost every year than at any other time in the last 10 million years. So this is according to a global science community studying the loss of species. So it's a really big deal. Every species is a really big deal. Pricelessly valuable. This is actually a picture that David took on a mountain caribou project. And those cameras from that project are now in on our Wolverine project. So mountain caribou are also important. But they don't have claws, so that's their one downside. Mountain biodiversity in particular is important because, well, you don't really think of the mountains as a very biodiverse place, perhaps, but they certainly are. And that's because there's a very steep environmental gradient as you increase in elevation. So, you know, it's not quite like the rainforest, Amazon rainforest concept, but there really are a number of climatic life zones and species that live within those life zones that are tied to precipitation and temperature. And so you move up a mountain and you could be passing through a number of different plant and animal communities. And this is an old idea. Actually, Alexander von Humboldt in the late 1700s went to climb what was thought to be the highest peak in the world, Chimborazo. And along the way took measurements of pressure and temperature and soil moisture and humidity, and was the first to really link together that, you know, climate factors and soil factors are tied to the animals and plants that live there. So he is considered by some people to be like the father of ecology. So it's a very old idea. Well, wolverines are tied to climatic factors. So this is the Western snowpack. And let's see if this thing works. So here we have April 1 snow water equivalent. And this is percent of median, 50% above, minus 50% below. The important thing to take out of this image here is that in the last 40 years, there's a downward trend in the amount of snow water equivalent. So that's tied to snowpack. And the wolverine depends on snowpack, specifically to raise their young. So this is not a great outlook for this species. And there's also direct impact from humans, from land use. So here's a historic range of wolverine. They used to be in the Sierra Nevada, in Colorado and Utah, and then all the way over, this is where I was raised, the Wolverine State, Michigan. And this is their current range, the darker red. So there's been a range retraction over time. And this is because they were extirpated. So they were hunted, and there were poison control programs for predators, and wolverines were killed off from the Cascades in all of this area here. So we already managed to impact wolverines, but the good news is that they're slowly beginning to recolonize the Cascades and into the Sawtooths in Idaho and also the Rockies. And they're doing that on their own, so there's no active reintroduction. They're just tenacious animals that have very far dispersal ranges. So they are kind of undergoing a natural experiment. But we are reducing snowpack, and we're affecting land use by building roads or using roads, and these things could, you know, retract their range again. So it's a sweet story in that they're recolonizing, but the future remains very uncertain. So this is a map of where spring snowpack persists into, well, spring snowpack persists into the middle of May. So that's the end of the denning period for wolverines. You can see all the blue, and then the edges are red, and the blue is the highest quality habitat. So you can see us, there's Washington Pass, and then you can see Lake Chelan. So you can tell where we are, just below that. So this is wolverine habitat. And in that habitat, there aren't that many. And it's helpful to kind of put it in perspective of other species on the landscape. So in Washington State, there's 7.3 million humans, and 100,000 coyote, 25,000 black bear, 2,200 cougar, 140 to 160 wolves, definitely less than 100 lynx. We don't really know. They're understudied. Probably fewer than 50. And 30 to 50 gulo, and gulo is the scientific name for wolverine. Gulo, gulo, gluttonous glutton. So here is a wolverine that is up, was up Twisp River, and he's, or she, is scavenging on a moose carcass. And that's not the sound of a wolverine. Does anyone know who that is? Raven. Wolverines are opportunistic feeders, so they do hunt small game, but they're really specialized to scavenge, and especially during winter. So this moose was killed by wolves. There were wolf tracks right around the carcass. But they also will scavenge on, let's say, like mountain goats that have been avalanched off of cliffs. So they're really good at taking advantage of food on the landscape in a low-resource environment. And they live down here in a very rugged environment. So they're tied to snow. So up north, they're not necessarily in the mountains. They're just wherever there's deep enough snow for them to reproduce young. But down here, you know, they have to stick where the snow is unless they're just traveling briefly out of their bioclimatic envelope. And they're good at finding food. Part of that is that they're able to travel a huge distance in order to find food. So this is from the North Cascades Wolverine Study, and each polygon is a different individual animal. So the red are females and the blue are males. And this is the distance that an individual would travel in about 6 to 8 months. So there's a Canadian border up there, and then this is North Cascades National Park right there. And this is Rocky, an individual wolverine. So that's the same amount of land as the entire North Cascades National Park. Then an animal, where's the wolverine hide now? That size, so you know, between 20 and 40 pounds travels within a season. Two seasons. So there's Rocky. And that information was gathered because he had a collar fitted to him. He's live trapped. And I think he was live trapped up near Washington Pass and then also up near Hart's Pass. And then he's fitted with the satellite collar and then monitored for a couple of years till the collar falls off. So the live trapping program was super productive in terms of data and learning about how wolverines interact with the landscape. But it's invasive, you know. They're sedated and they're handled, and I'm sure they don't like that bling, you know, around their necks. Maybe they do. I don't know. Maybe it attracts, you know, the other mate. Who knows? But, you know, it's invasive. And it's also very expensive, and it's fairly dangerous because biologists need to go up to the trap to release the animal pretty soon, within 12 hours, ideally, in avalanche terrain, you know. So they have to deal with all conditions. That program is over, and we're kind of moving into a new era of non-invasive monitoring. So this is remote camera trapping stations. And Cascades Wolverine Project is just up in this area, so Holden and then in the Matt Howe Valley, east side of the North Cascades. And there are other programs. So there's a program down near Mount Rainier, which is really cool. Jocelyn Akins at Cascades Carnivore Project. And then Woodland Park Zoo. There's a few patchwork programs. And the reason there's so many programs is because wolverines are warranted to be considered a threatened species, but politics says no. So they don't have status or any kind of protection. And what's interesting about wolverines is that they live on public land for the most part. So there's their habitat, which is a bioclimatic envelope, the spring snowpack, the blue. And then this is federal land. So the light green is multi-use, managed for multi-use, including, you know, logging and resource extraction, recreation. The darker green is wilderness, so that's more protected. So actually, this species is doing pretty well. Like, they have, you know, their land is managed in part to have pretty low impact other than, you know, a changing climate. But the edges are not necessarily in their favor, right? So federal land, they have no federal protection. So it's interesting conundrum for this, for the conservation of this species. So a bunch of monitoring happens, and usually with trail cameras. Mark and Nancy pulled down cameras last spring, which is very kind. Mina, who is, no, she's not here now, but she initiated, and Mary, is Mary here?
Maybe.
They really spearheaded having a monitoring station via Conservation Northwest. So, you know, we're as a community, we're getting the cameras out there so that we can keep track of these animals and hopefully learn some more about them. But this is kind of like the typical photograph that you get from one of these research stations. And I think I'm going to pass this off to David pretty soon here, because we're doing something. Oh, actually, this is a local camera trap photo. So this is up Railroad Creek. So this is just from last spring in April. So not very far from the village, which is pretty exciting. And this is up in Copper Basin. So that the date is not wrong. It's not from 2013, it's from last spring. But this is up. Has anyone been up in the Copper Basin, taking a hike or something?
Yeah.
Is any, and just a raise of hands, who has actually seen a wolverine? Anybody? So three down here. And has anyone seen wolverine tracks? A few more. Maybe, yeah, nice. So that's a pretty impressive number for this group of people. Usually, most people have never even heard of a wolverine, so we're in wolverine mecca here in Oldham Village. So we're adding something to this. This is part of the storytelling part, which is some engaging visuals, right? So you can see these animals in without all of the garb and the low resolution of the trail cameras. This is, I think David's going to talk a bit more about this.
Awesome. Well, this is a really fun project for me. I do my work, all of it involves some level of wildlife conservation, outdoor adventure. I work as a am I too loud? I can, sorry.
No.
Okay. You want to?
Whatever.
Go for it. How's that? Better? Good? Good? Okay, great. So I do some work as a biologist, but on this project I get to focus on, a lot of my work is also as a photographer and with visual storytelling. So it's great to work with Steph, where she can wear the science hat and I can wear a little bit more of the photographer artwork hat, and it's a great, I just really appreciate it. So, yeah, along with kind of keeping track of these animals on a scientific level, so much of the work we have today, I believe, in conservation is not really about understanding animals, it's about understanding humans and helping humans understand wildlife and wild places and our connection to them. And so a lot of What I'm interested here in doing is basically bringing the Wolverine and the places that Wolverines call home out of the wilderness and bringing them to people and helping people see and appreciate these landscapes and develop an affinity for that and also develop a sense of kinship with these places. And some of that might inspire people to come back out to these places. A lot of what we do is actually working with folks that do spend a lot of time out here already, so we're trying to enrich their understanding and appreciation of the landscape that's out there. And really just connecting to, there's kind of an archetypal experience of being out there with these animals. I know that, I believe for me and Steph, part of our attraction to wolverines is that we feel like we can relate to them, that we travel through these same landscapes and we leave our tracks in the snow as well. And there's like a interaction that goes back and forth. These are wolverine tracks going up through Copper Basin last year. And I don't know about you guys, but being here in Holden Village, I'm sure you find fresh tracks and you just want to know where they go. And hopefully you have some chances to just follow them and go see how these animals live in this mountain environment and just be blown away that like right now out there, those wolverines we had photos of are out there sleeping in a hole in the snow probably right now. Pretty crazy. And we're in here in our own little warm environment, but it gives us a sense of just the amazing animals that these are. This project in particular, Steph talked a lot about how a lot of wolverine habitat's protected, but really what is protected in the 21st century? And climate change really suggests that wilderness and land designations aren't enough to really see animals like wolverines through to the future. And at the same time, the idea of wilderness and protected areas is a bit of a fallacy. It's a settler colonial construction that humans are different than nature. And there's places that people aren't supposed to go. And if we look at the reality of how people have lived on the land since time immemorial, is that it's always a back and forth, a going between. And actually these mountains have been home for humans that have traveled into them to collect food and things they needed to make their livelihood for thousands and thousands of years right alongside the wolverine. So figuring out where is it that we fit in this system and what is our place in it, and perhaps our cultural stories of the past century or two don't quite fit for what we need for the future. So a lot of what we're doing is thinking about where is it, where is our place in these environments? What is our new way of, interacting with this landscape? Another piece that I am really intrigued about with wolverines and the experience of spending time in the space of wolverines in the 21st century is the sense of being surrounded by something much larger than ourselves in a space that is really beyond our control, right? The forces at play in landscapes like this, in the places that wolverines travel through freely, are just so immense and so vast. And that's a really unique opportunity to experience that for modern people in a developed country like the United States. So I love those opportunities. I think a lot of you probably enjoy them as well if you're in a place like this. As Steph mentioned, we work a lot with the backcountry ski community, and this is a community that really knows the snow and the mountains in a very intimate way, probably more intimately than most other people in the world, and in a similar way to wolverines. They can watch the weather and know what the snow conditions are going to be like, and that'll affect where and how they travel, and it's the same for wolverines. So there's a kinship there. For me, one of the goals and the things that I'm after here in the work that we're doing is to help us understand that this is our playground. Like, this is a beautiful place to go recreate and to rejuvenate. And for them, this is their last stand. This is their last refuge. This is a place that is more than just a spot to find refuge. It's a place to feed themselves and just a really vital place. So how do we, as people that are feeding ourselves from other places in the world and coming out here to enjoy ourselves, how do we do that in a way that gives back to, cares for, respects the places that we travel? So engaging those conversations for sure. So recreation in, you know, those moments like this, right? Moments like this and this for us, somewhere if you go back far enough in that experience, you're gonna end up with something like this, right? Which is that we live messy lives, right? And all of us, I mean, just to get here to Holden Village, right? We burn fossil fuels, the clothing that we wear, the industrial agriculture, all of these things, these are important parts of our conservation ethic and effort, right? And so, you know, how we travel in the wilderness is an important part of the story and the conversation, but so is all the things we do outside of the wilderness, and arguably even more important. And so how do we make those connections between the places that we love and the places that we recreate and our choices beyond that, and even how we get out there? Beyond that, there's a burgeoning outdoor recreation industry, and it really is. It's definitely an industry, and whenever you hear the word industry after something, it means that there's an extractive nature to it, right? And I have a snowmobile up here, but it could be skiing or even snowshoeing, anything where you start trying to make money off of something, so recreation has become big business, then you're going to start seeing where you're going to want to get more and more people out there into more and new places because there's money to be made. And then actually in our society where we've actually, especially in the Pacific Northwest, developed an understanding and appreciation of how traveling in places like this fills our soul, right? But there's 7.3 million of us in the state, right? And so that has impacts. Even when we're going out there with the best of intentions, that can have significant impacts. And actually, there's research that has been done on the impacts of winter recreation on wolverines and places with lots of traffic, especially mechanized traffic that's off trail, can have significant impacts on how wolverines use those landscapes. So this is another part of the conversation that we are trying to engage folks with and to look at, not as like, you shouldn't go out there. I mean, this is something we love to do ourselves, but as a point of reckoning and thinking about how is it that we're managing our own choices in relationship to other creatures and the spaces that we love. Here's Drew Lavelle, Steph's husband, and this is up in the upper Copper Basin. He's digging a snow pit. He works as an avalanche forecaster for the mine. And snowpack is important not just for wolverines. This is another point of connection, and you may not think about it, but it's a very important point of connection for all of us. Anybody that lives here in the Pacific Northwest, snowpack is vital for our lives and the survival of our contemporary culture, in that it provides the water that irrigates crops. It provides the water that produces the electricity that we use across the Pacific Northwest that goes far and wide. So this is another interesting part of the story that is many folks are oblivious to, how important the snowpack is for us. And so goes the wolverine, so goes our lives as well. And so how do we, you know, kind of understand and experience that? Most folks don't experience it by digging a 6-foot hole in the snow to carefully inspect what's in there. So the other thing that really makes me very curious and kind of I'm intrigued by, and I think people connect to, the scavenger in wolverines is, it's really ironic to me that wolverines, the Latin name, this is classic for Western civilization, the Latin name for wolverines, the gluttonous glutton, right? So here's an animal that will literally, like, we're feeding them roadkill deer. That's what we brought out here to feed these guys. And they will eat all of it. They'll eat the long bones to get the marrow out of it, right? How many of you are interested in picking up a roadkill deer that's been rotting on the side of the road and like eating the brains and the skull and all of that stuff, right? Right? No, you know, this is a very different creature, but we have projected onto it the idea that it's the glutton, right? It's not us that cruise down the road killing wildlife as we go, leaving them on the side of the road to rot, right? It's them. They're the glutton. And so there's, again, this opportunity for us to look into the other and see maybe things that we don't want to see in ourselves. And I think that's quite interesting. Forrest McBrien right here, who was up here last winter, is a vegetarian. But he is very into wolverines, and so he'll do the work that needs to be done to carry on with the project. And, you know, honestly, he sees it a bit as a spiritual experience. And I was just talking about this with another friend who was like, oh, it's because I picked up a roadkill deer just recently, and part of it I did collect for myself, the backstrap, which is great meat. It had just been killed that day. It was good meat. And so I ate that, and then some of it we brought here to feed to the wolverines, and we're sharing a meal with the wolverines. He's like, oh, it's a sacrament of sharing, you know, sharing a meal with and bringing food to offer to another being. So I thought that was kind of interesting to think about. So here's just a few photos from the work that we're doing out there. Steph's an avid tree climber in the winter because we try to get the bait up high in the tree. So ironically, we try not to feed the animals. Right, we're trying to keep the food, the bait, as an attractant, so it's dangling where they can come and look at it, but can't quite get to it. But that doesn't always work. As Steph mentioned, wolverines are very good at finding food, and if they see there's something good to eat, they often will figure out a way to get to it. This is a camera trap view of the world, setting up a station there in the winter. A lot of our work when we're out in places, especially here in Holden Village, it's quiet because everybody just has to come through here. But when we're working in other places where there's a lot of recreation, they're always fascinated about the work we're doing. So we try to be emissaries for the creatures and the work that we're doing out there. So, but I also want to share just here's a few images of the creatures that we see out there in the landscapes that we're working. So this, anybody know what this is? I just learned is the mascot for this local school. Very good. This is actually from Open Copper Basin. As is this one. This is a pine marten with a squirrel in its mouth. Again, also up in Copper Basin. And this one also felt like, have you ever had a cat present you with something? Yeah, I felt very much that way when I saw those photos. We capture some really fun moments in the lives of these animals. Seemed like these guys got along. It's sometimes hard to tell. So, it's not just mammals out there. Oh, did anybody know who this is? You must have them around here. What's that? Gray jay. Yeah, also known as a camp robber. Closely related, this is a Clark's Nutcracker. You guys have those around here? I'm sure you do. So these camera, the photos that we get, especially the night shots, just feel almost kind of dreamlike, right? You capture these moments in the lives of animals that we know are out there, but how often do we get to see them or see them in this kind of intimate way? So, I just kind of imagine the lights coming on and just the snow falling and this critter out there doing its work, and we just get these brief moments of, you know, what's going on in their lives. Nice. Cool. So I think that was a little bit of kind of the art and vision that we had behind the work that we're doing. And we'll kind of move towards wrapping up here with sharing a few images of their tracks, because this is a great way that you guys might interact with them and see tracks. And if you do, we'd love to hear about it. We actually, on our website, CascadesWolverineProject.org, there's a form you can fill out. If you've seen tracks, you can upload your photos to it, tell us where you saw them, and we'll help you figure out if indeed it was a wolverine. And if it was, then it'll go into our database of community submitted observations, such as this one from the North Cascades by Forrest. So one of the things with wolverine tracks that you'll notice is that they run a lot. So most of the time when you see their tracks, you'll see a bounding pattern. You'll see a set of tracks and then a big space and a set of tracks and a space. And often they're at this angle. They kind of do this loping pattern that leaves this angled set of two tracks, or sometimes three, going off across the landscape. So here's a close-up with a ski looking down at it. Here's a set of two wolverines. Here's one wolverine, and here's another one running towards you. Another quick story while we're on the subject of tracks. Last year, when we were up in Copper Basin, we skied up into Copper Basin, did camera trap, went a little bit higher to do some skiing, and on our way back down, there were fresh wolverine tracks coming down and walking on our ski tracks and then cutting off. And right here, it had urinated on our ski tracks. And then we followed its tracks off in the snow, which we were pretty excited about. Here's another elongated running pattern. There's a set of tracks and a space and a set of tracks, kind of at an angle. But again, there's this opportunity where it's like, wow, this is a two-way street of communication, right? We're talking to these animals. We're giving them messages. We may have no idea what the messages are that we're sending them, and they're sending messages back to us, right? And it's a pretty good chance that wolverine could smell us and recognize that we were the people that, you know, potentially have been to these cameras. So keeping track of who's in his neighborhood or her neighborhood in the same way that we're trying to do that as well. So going back to a little bit more of the details here, here's a wolverine foot. Those are centimeters. A big thing, if you want to think about how big a wolverine's track is, their footprint is about the size of my palm. Right? And you can look at this animal, the bottoms of its feet aren't there, but you can see that's a pretty big track, right? This is an animal like a coyote, which is a similar weight, has a track that's about a third the size. So their tracks are actually as big as a mountain lion or a wolf, even though they're much smaller creatures. They got five toes on their front and hind feet, a little skinny palm pad, a lot of fur, and here's some more photos of their tracks in case you see them out there. That's my hand in there. So again, to give you a sense, it's like the size of my hand. It's a 6-inch ruler right here. So they're kind of, I like to think of them kind of like an ice cream cone. Here's the ice cream, here's the cone. So if you see some loping ice cream cones out there, it's probably a wolverine. So, and then just to give you another sense of the track pattern that I was talking about, a lot of bounding stuff. If you find other animals like bobcats or coyotes up here, a lot of the time they'll be walking or trotting, so they'll leave an alternating pattern, kind of like you would when you're walking. And wolverines will do that for a little bit, but they'll typically do this bounding pattern, so you get clumps of tracks spread out. And martens will do the same thing, but they're smaller. Very similar to a wolverine, but smaller. So another one of those loping patterns. Again, you can see a group of three tracks right here. Spreading out, three tracks, space, three tracks. Just a few more images to put in your head. This is another friend of the project who submitted wolverine tracks, a backcountry skier guide. Mm-hmm. There's another one. Cool. So I'm going to pass it back to Steph to talk a little bit about, to wrap it up.
Thanks, Dave. Those are impressive images, huh? So, Yeah, so we do rely on a lot of people to support us, which is fun. It's fun to engage. We have two volunteers with us, a longtime builder and backcountry skier, Mike. Where is Mike? I don't know. Over there. So that was really great to install our stations and to be able to travel in rough terrain. And also Nick March over here actually secured our funding for year 1, 2, and 3. He's with Patagonia, and we're indebted to him. And was out in the field in the mashed potatoes with us for about 6 days. So also in the field. So if you see tracks and you have a solid internet connection, so it might not happen here at the village, and then you can go to our website, and we have some information on Wolverine tracks. So a lot of the info and diagrams that Dave just showed are there as a reference. And then you can submit your observation. And that comes usually to me. So if I don't get back to you right away, it's because I'm in the mountains. But I will. I'll get back as soon as possible. And this is really important information. Incidental observations is what we call them, is really kind of critical to the entire research community. So I send that off to the Forest Service in Olympia for the verifiable detection database, and also to Conservation Northwest, so it gets to the right people. You can also donate. We always need funds. So you can go to Conservation Northwest, and they, if you put Cascades Wolverine Project in the note box, and they will send us that donation, and every dollar really does matter. You can go the extra mile and actually set up a station on your own, like Mina, Mary, the Holden staff have done. Also, what's your name again? You're the one who's...
Mike.
Mike is maintaining the station currently. Thank you.
A group of us are.
A group.
Yeah.
Is anyone else in this room involved in that?
Is Andrew here?
Maybe Andrew. Yeah. Nice. Thank you. Sweet. So that's... Conservation Northwest has done well over 15 years? A long time of wildlife monitoring, including wolverines. So you can go through a whole training program and set up one of these stations. And then I just want to give a shout out to the many people who have supported us in all sorts of ways. And I think that's it. So if you have any questions, we'd love to attempt to answer them. Thanks a lot. Thank you so much for your attention, for being here.
So I was told that wolverines pee everywhere on everything. Is that true?
It sure seems that way. We have, you know, at the stations, we have images of them scent marking. So that's a kind of message to other animals that this is a place that they're interested in. So scent marking, even our skin track. So apparently we were getting this wolverine stash, and they scent marked our skin track to say, what are you doing here? So yes, that is a way of communicating. You know, especially one animal managing a very large territory. Like a female might be 100 square miles, a male might be 250 square miles. In some areas, up to 1,000 square miles. So they're constantly leaving little messages, markers, that this is where I live, this is what I'm interested in. So they do tend to pee. And they actually have a very stinky anal scent gland, which is used actually more of as a defensive. So they're also known as skunk bears, and that's from back in the trapper days. And when they would get into a trapper's cabin, apparently often they would like spook themselves with pots and pans and like just spray some really, really foul odor. But that's not for scent marking. That's more of a defensive thing. Any other? Yes.
So would a wolverine like attack you if you saw it coming?
You know, there are no recordings of wolverines attacking humans other than a trapper who had thought that he had killed the wolverine, put him around his neck, and started walking back to the cabin and was attacked. So that is the...
Attacked.
Vicious animals. So they are, they are high energy. They're weasels. They have super high metabolism. So they might appear to be, you know, vicious, like those Marvel Comics heroes. And the way they eat, actually, they can't, like, you can do this with your jaw, right? And a wolverine cannot, so they can only go up and down. It's so that they can crush through frozen bone. So when they eat, it looks really crazy and kind of like, yeah, scary. So I think they've earned themselves a much more vicious reputation than they might deserve. Yeah.
So how much do they eat per day?
Oh, that's a great question. I have no idea. And that kind of falls into the mystery of, you know, an animal that's very difficult to study in captivity. Maybe their consumption is different than it would be in the wild. But that's a great... Do you have a...
Yeah, just to speak to that as well, about how much they eat.
It's different every day. So, and if they get to a moose carcass, they will eat as much as they possibly can, recognizing that something bigger and badder might show up the next day that will deny them access to it. So a lot of carnivores are like that way, but especially scavengers will, it's feast or famine, quite literally feast or famine. And they might get done with that moose carcass and go foraging somewhere else, and it sits there for 8 days and they found nothing else to eat. So they go back and then they start cracking open the bones and seeing what else they can get out of it. So it really would vary from day to day. The question is, how many young do they have? So I don't know their typical litter size. I would guess it's, is it 2 to 3? 2 to 3. They have a really interesting reproductive cycle. So they breed in the summer, right after the female gives birth, and she comes into estrus after that, hooks up with the male. They breed, and then the... embryo goes into like a state of suspended animation. It's called delayed implantation. So that embryo just sits inside of the female all the way through the summer, through the fall, into the winter, and then in the late winter it starts gestating, so that the kits are born in the spring, which is the best time, the most likely time that there'll be plenty to feed them. And then that cycle repeats itself. So it's another part of their biology that's really paired to the environment that they live in, which is pretty exciting. So
are you using flash for the nighttime photography?
Like great. Yeah. So the question was the lighting. So yes. So it's I like to think about camera trapping. It's like studio photography in the wilderness with a very, very fickle model. It's like, you're like, do this, and it's like, I don't want to. I'll do it, but I'll do it over here. So yeah, so we use 2 to 3 strobes, and it's not like the little box cameras. It's like a legit camera inside of a homemade waterproof housing. And then the animal triggers the camera. Same way if you walk out your door and the light goes on. So their motion triggers the camera to go off, and we do our best guess, bet, to figure out where we think the animal is going to be and set up everything around that so that it can take the photo. And so it's really like Christmas when you get a great shot. Last year, we ran 5 of these camera stations, and we got over, I'm not joking, over 10,000 photos of pine martens. And we got 1 series of photos of a wolverine that turned out like this. We got other detections, but not on our DSLR camera shaft. So it's really like hitting a grand slam when you get one.
Could you talk a little bit about any differences that you've seen since you started trying to, like with the visual storytelling, trying to communicate what you know to a larger audience?
Differences in terms of...
The
biggest differences I see is in myself, and one of the things that happens when we do these is we end up with lots of conversations, and the questions we get and the stories we get and the places where we bump, you know, you guys seem like a pretty receptive audience. I don't feel like we're going to get any hardball questions about, like, you know, whether, you know, sometimes you'll be in an audience where there's people that are pretty upset about conservation issues, or you mention things like climate change, and you know that could lead to a whole another series of conversations. And so for me, as a conservationist and somebody that's trying to tell stories that not so much convince you to do one thing or another, but engage communities in conversations and try to help us. If we're trying to look across the barrier between us and a wolverine to understand how a wolverine sees the world and what a wolverine needs to survive, I think it's also similarly true that a big part of what we're trying to do is look across the divides that separate us, you know, one part of our culture from another. And there really are very distinctive cultural groups in our country. As homogeneous, as much of a melting pot as we'd like to believe we are, we actually have very different cultural perspectives on things like conservation and wildlife and the role of recreation and how we manage land. All these things are really big opportunities for us to understand each other. And so I'm constantly looking for ways and trying to figure out what are the images and what are the messages that will help let those guards come down so we can have real conversations about this. And one thing that I often think about is these animals, when they're looking back at us in these cameras, a lot of times they're probably pretty nervous, right? And it's actually true whenever you see wildlife and they look at you. How often have you seen wildlife where they're looking at you and you know what they're thinking is like, are you going to hurt me? Are you going to take away something that I want or need to survive? And when you look at people that get really upset about things, often you can see those same responses, right? It may not be on the same visceral level. It may not be, are you going to take this moose carcass that's going to feed me, right? It may be something more like, are the things that you're proposing going to take away the livelihood that I have been doing my whole life and has been part of the culture that I grew up in? Because I find that threatening. And I don't know what I would do, and I don't know what my kids were going to do if we changed the status quo. And for me, if it's reasonable for a wolverine to have those fears, it's reasonable for any human being that I interact with to have those fears. So finding ways, hopefully through these animals in this story, which is really compelling at its base, to bridge those gaps and figure out what is the way forward for all of us people and wolverines alike.
Yeah.
How many stations do you guys have up in the valley around this area?
So this year we're going to have 3 DSLR stations. So up Roller Creek, Big Creek, Copper Basin, and we ask that if you see the stations, please don't trigger the cameras, because a lot of effort goes into setting that up and the batteries can drain. So it really is important to kind of give a little space if you see one of those stations. And then up in the Methow, we currently have 3, 5, soon to be 7, probably 6 or 7 up in the Methow. So a little of that is just, can we get out when the conditions are right?
And then just to tag on to that, so the 2 parts of our science, one are these cameras, but then the other part, which hopefully is going to become a much larger part, is the community science. And so for that, we have observers all over the place. And we got 20 submissions about last year, which was over 4 times as many as the year before, and we'd love to go 4 times more. And I'll just say that we got 3 from here in Holden.
Yeah.
So if you guys could get us 9, that'd be great next year. So the number of places we're going to have observations in part depends on you guys. So bring it on.
The camera stations, how often do you check up on them, and how long does the battery last in the hole?
Yeah, the batteries are depend on how often they're triggered. And the flash batteries, would you say, go off the are drained the quickest, huh?
If we check a station after 2 weeks and it's not all working, we're kind of disappointed. If we go back a month after a month and it's all working, I'm shocked. So you get kind of 2 to 4 weeks. The research stations can go much longer. If it's just the little trail camera, those can go for months.
Yeah, so we basically have 3 to 4. We have 4 field hitches, I like to call them. So weeks in the field, including setting them up, checking them, and then taking them down. And we could do more, we just have to raise a little bit more funding to do that. So, yeah. Yeah.
How do you choose the location?
Yeah, the locations are based first on that bioclimatic envelope, so the persistent spring snowpack, the image where we had, you know, an overlay of the blue and the white and the red. So we first go on the macro level to where the snowpack persists into spring, because that's where viable populations exist. That's where females can reproduce. Of course, they exist outside of there, especially dispersing males, which have dispersed as far as the Sierra Nevada. So on the micro level, so that's natural funnels for wildlife activity, like wildlife corridors, like a steep incised valley near tree line, ideally, maybe near a slide path, an avalanche path. And then a really nice view is also something that is unique to our, that's David's, yeah, high maintenance. So if we can get something that really shows the habitat, you know, maybe not just in the forest, but with the peaks in the background, then that's a really sweet spot. So it takes us a little extra long to find our locations. Yeah. They're also in Scandinavia, the east side of Scandinavia especially, so Finland, and then a little bit in Sweden and Norway, and also in Russia. So, and this animal came from an island off the eastern coast of Russia, Kamchatka Island, which is in the Bering Sea. Yeah. Yeah, for the first couple of years, offspring usually stick pretty close by to their mother, and their father will also come visit them and walk around with them and hang out. And then they'll disperse, you know? So females have smaller territories, so they may not have to disperse as far, but they might have to if there's another female that's real close by. And then males, too, can disperse quite a distance. So it depends on which territories are available. There have been wolverine attacks noted in the past, so we're not exactly sure what the nature of that was, if it was territoriality or just a skirmish. Animals definitely have personalities, so it's kind of hard to nail that one down.
What was the story about Stella that you started about in the beginning?
Oh, yeah. Stella. She's our star, our diva of the wolverines. Stella was first camera trapped in 2015 up near Hart's Pass, north and west of Mazama, and a little bit of fur got caught at the station, so they found out that she was female, and that's kind of about it. So as soon as the Forest Service gets a genetic sample, they feel like they can name an individual. So it's possible to track individuals based on their chest blaze. Like if you hold up that hide there underneath the chin, yeah, underneath the chin, there's a pattern that's unique to every individual, like a fingerprint. So if we can get that view on the camera, then we can also identify an individual. So Stella was 2015 at Hart's Pass, and she's 20 kilometers south in 2016. Then we got her on our cameras in 2018 and then 2019. And so that's Stella right there. And you can see her chest blaze. So we're really psyched on this, and we're really attentive, especially there's been local skiers who have noticed a wolverine going into a hole in the snow in a specific location. Female den sites are the prize for wolverine biologists. We know very little about where they den, and that is the limiting factor to their survival in the long term. So if we know where females are denning, and they don't do it every year, and there's only 30 or 40 of them around in the mountains perhaps, then we can put a buffer around that area. Let's say limit mechanized or ski touring activity. Try to, you know, ensure that this female has a chance at really raising young successfully. Yeah.
Any sense of the mortality for the young?
Yeah, good question. I don't know, especially here. It's a very rough life. They can get plucked off when they're really young, even by birds of prey or other predators on the landscape. So they're quite vulnerable. So I don't know. I don't know what the mortality rate is for young. But considering how few of them are on the landscape, I'm pretty sure it's not, 100% survivorship.
And I would just say if they typically have 2 to 3 kits in a litter, that would be low on average for an animal that size. So they're about the size of a coyote. And a coyote litter would be about twice that. And that's probably a function of the fact that they live in a very resource-poor environment, so they would reproduce less. So that sets them back
to begin with, not to mention that then the young have to survive in a harsh landscape. So my guess, like many other animals that live in that environment, is their reproductive success is very low. And so every individual that gets recruited into the population is really important, which slows the rate of recovery for a species.
What's the relationship with other carnivores? Like, who might even prey on wolverines is a good question, you know? Like, and then who do they prey on? So, actually, this is a story that I've heard from a bush pilot in Alaska, and then also from Audrey McGowan, who's kind of a star wolverine biologist in Alaska, that it's been witnessed a couple of times, you know, some carrion. Let's say it's like a moose that's been killed, and a grizzly and a wolverine. A grizzly and a wolverine are going for the same animal to scavenge. A wolverine has been known to jump on the back of a grizzly. I mean, so this is like eyewitness from a reliable source, a friend of mine, and actually fend off that carcass. So this is a 30 to 40 pound animal against a grizzly. They're not always gonna win, but they're gonna try. So they're not intimidated very easily. But you know, you can imagine that if there could be an interaction where a predator like a wolf, especially in a pack, could have a chance at getting a wolverine for sure, especially their kits, who are pretty vulnerable anytime that they're out of their snow den. And otherwise they're not like a keystone species, right? So they don't have this significant noticeable effect on the rest of the ecosystem. But they're an indicator species. So where wolverines exist, because they travel such large territories, it does imply a measure of ecosystem health and connectivity. So for this kind of an island population, because they're in the mountains where the snow persists, if they're here, it means that there's some kind of connection to the Coast Mountains and to the Columbia Mountains and the Rockies, where they could be dispersing from, and to keep the genetics diverse within the population. So a lot of biologists feel like, you know, they're scavenger, they're kind of on the fringes, they're kind of a dirtbag. I feel really connected from my previous life as a dirtbag, scavenging expired food and such, you know, just kind of living on the edges a little bit. That's the relationship, is how I feel like it best describes them. But they're a great indicator species for healthy ecosystems. Yes. Oh, that's a great question. So a female probably won't start reproducing until you're 2 or 3 years old, and they might live in the wild 8 to 10 years. They could live close to 20 years in captivity, or just a really lucky wolverine. And so if they're giving birth, let's say every 2 or 3 years, so not every year, so that's maybe, you know, 6 to 8, maybe more, depending on how long a female lives over the course of her life. Yeah.
So wait, every 2 or 3 years, so it's that frequent that the conditions aren't good enough to gestate?
Yeah. It's a hard life, you know? Yeah. Yeah, if, as a scavenger who doesn't hibernate, who needs to find resources in winter. Yeah, I know. It's impressive. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Could you maybe explain a little bit of the method to your stations, like with the run poles and the kind of
yeah.
Describe that a little more?
Yeah, so there's a few different ways of getting at genetics, which are really interesting for Cascades wolverines, since we killed off the Cascades wolverine strain, you could say. So we're interested if we can get any of that remnant population, or if they just simply don't exist. Thus far, they don't exist. So we feel pretty sure that we extirpated the original Cascades wolverines. All of the genetics come from the north, from BC. So there's a lot of important information from getting a sample. You can get that through the hair, through a hair snare, hair snagger. So like what we have are these gun brushes mounted on a piece of fabric, and we wrap it around a tree and put some bait above so that some of the hair rubs off on those gun brushes. Another is a run pole, and we would love to get you a hair sampling kit where you actually use like alligator clips from doing electronics, right? And you put them on either side of a kind of a goalpost frame, and the animal will walk out the end of the run pole, get some fur snagged for the genetic sample, and then lift their paws up, so on the hind legs, exposing the chest blazes for the camera, to kind of, you know, reach for the bait. So that's the primo station. What you have is primo. It also, it takes a lot to install and maintain. You can also find out if a female is lactating. Otherwise, you can't tell unless you get that genetic sample if this is a male or female. So then you'll be able to see if the teats are swollen from that setup. Our setup is a little bit different because we're trying to get some photography as well. But we're also working with trying to get this protocol going for genetic samples from tracks. So we could actually get really useful information this year by collaborating with Rocky Mountain Research Station and Cascades Carnivore Project by sampling snow and amplifying degraded DNA. And that would be awesome. So this is all kind of new science that we're working on. Maybe a couple more.
Yeah, is there anything that can be done to improve the protected status at the state or federal level besides supporting what y'all are doing?
Right, well, you can definitely voice your concern at gutting the Endangered Species Act, which the current administration is doing. And they're specifically rolling back protections for threatened species rather than endangered, which is the highest level of protection. So, and rolling back the limiting the role of climate change in determining a species protection. So any opportunities that you have to vote to try to combat what's happening currently with the Endangered Species Act would be helpful. There's also something that Conservation Northwest, if you go to their website, is supporting, which is the Recovering America's Wildlife Act. And that's a way to try to fund at the state level. Washington State advocates for wolverine protection. But again, their land, there's hardly any wolverines on state land, and so they have to work with the federal government, and you just hit some blockages there. So supporting this Recovering America Wildlife Act would put funds toward critical, especially climate-related species, work to protect those habitats and those animals.
And I'll just say, you know, my honest assessment is that if we deal with climate change, we may have a chance of saving wolverines. And if we don't, nothing else will matter. And it's true for a lot of species. And I'd say that's really the indicator that they are, is they're connected to places that have snow. And so climate change is their biggest threat. And so if you want to do something to care for wolverines, it's help us deal with climate change. And that can happen on a lot of levels. I think the fact, what we've seen with the federal government really stepping back or like walking back, running backwards away from dealing with climate change, that states and cities and counties and municipalities are stepping up. And so there's tons of opportunities for us to be thinking about how we step into dealing with that issue on a variety of different levels. So whatever, wherever you come from, however you deal with that, no matter where you are in the world, dealing with climate change is wolverine conservation. And I think that's absolutely critical for us to think about for sure.
Maybe one more, if anyone has another question, and then we'll wrap it up.
We did it. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for hanging in.